Welcome everyone to second day of the Marxism 2011 conference, and this what will be, I think, a very special session of this conference. I want to begin by acknowledging that this conference takes place on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, that is the stolen land of those people. We pay respect to their elders past and present, and we acknowledge that ownership of this land was never ceded, that it always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So let's begin with that. Our speaker today, and I almost feel like you've all come because you already know his significance, is Gary Foley. Gary's a veteran Aboriginal activist. When I asked him how he wanted to be introduced, he suggested that I should say one thing in particular, that he'd been a star on A Country Practice. Perhaps not known to all of you, not known to me before this. But I'll tell you, I sat down with Gary at lunch, and in 10 minutes, I learnt so many things. Like, why don't I know these names? Why don't I know more about this and so on? And I think this is the kind of privilege that we've got to actually tap that mind, tap that experience, and tap that activism, that whole process of having been an activist from an early age and never stopping. So over to you, Gary.
Thank you. I'd like to pay my respects to all the old people here today. Welcome. Welcome. I feel sort of out of place in a conference like this, only a little bit. Being an old anarchist, and one who's sort of been all over the place politically over the years, I suppose. My thing these days, my thing always has been history. My particular obsession is history. What I'm interested in is history. I spent the first part of my life making history, and courtesy of an insult delivered to me by the then head of the history department at this here august institution, the University of Melbourne, very late in life I became one of the things I hated most, and that is an academic historian, folks. And so, as a historian, it is of interest to me that people, especially inform people and thinkers, which is what I'm assuming I'm looking at in a place like this, in a conference like this. I'm interested in the thinkers in Australia being much more aware of their own history. When I talk about history, I'm not talking about Australian history, I'm not talking about Indigenous history, I'm talking about our history. A history that virtually none of you know really all that much about. Just before I come in here today, I wandered around out there in the foyer. And there's an impressive number of books out there, folks. The most impressive number of books. I was amazed at how many tables of books there are. But there's only two little tiny tables right up the back there in the end room. They've got Australian history. Anything to do with Australian history about them. It's not enough at a place like this. Not enough attention. I've got no problems with you expanding your mind with the writings and ideas of whoever you like, a multitude of people in life, more the merrier. But all I'm saying is spare enough time in your thinking and your readings and your understandings to consider Australian history, because in a sense we're all part of the same problem here, you know. I was telling John Pilger yesterday that out where I teach these days, in a far more humane place than the University of Melbourne, out of Victoria Uni in the western suburbs, I still, a generation later, show a new generation of young Australian kids, 18, 19 years old. I show them a film that John made back in 1987, a film called The Secret Country. I think there's copies of the book here I saw yesterday. But in that film, I can show these kids that film. And I've got a new generation, the latest generation, who've come and said to me, you know, in 40 years, a few generations now, I've said this, and they say, how come we didn't know this? And fortuitously these days, a lot of these young kids who are saying this to me are young student teachers. And I say to them, well, your job is to ensure that the generation that you teach don't end up coming to me at the end of my lecture when I'm 85 years old and saying to me, how come we didn't know? It's your job. I said, remember what Chairman Mao said, educate yourself, then educate the people. That's what I've always been all about. That's what I'm still about to this day. And I probably will be as long as my push bike downstairs, my trusty iron steed that takes me everywhere I go in Melbourne, everywhere I need to go, because I'm an adopted member of the Tram Tracks Dreaming, which means that I don't go beyond the Tram Tracks of Melbourne, folks. That's outside my territory. So, having been inducted into the Tram Tracks Dreaming by none other than the legend of Tram Tracks Dreaming, Mr. Bruce McGuinness, one of the great forgotten heroes of the Aboriginal struggle, what I want to talk to you a little bit about, I've only got a little bit of short time, and I'm going to try and take you through 100 years of Australian history in lightning fashion in less than 30 minutes. It's a talk that it normally takes me 4 hours to do it over two sessions at uni, but you're going to get it in 30 minutes. Most people who turn up in Indigenous studies subjects at any level in university or schools, wherever you go, are people who turn up expecting to get fed all this mumbo jumbo about, you know, dot paintings and fancy dancing and the spirituality of the land and all that sort of stuff. I say to people, I can easily teach you all of that, but at the end of the session, you won't have the slightest bit of an idea of what's going on in Australia right now. You know, what the problem is right now and what we really need to be thinking about right now. You'd have no conception, no understanding. People who want to get into art and culture end up being completely and absolutely ignorant of what's going on around them in the real world today. And there is much to that. Well, let's put it this way, folks. When I was 17 years old, courtesy of a good kicking by the 21 Division in Regent Street Police Station in Redfern, I became politicised overnight. One of the best things that the New South Wales Constabulary ever did for me. But one of the reasons I got angry when I was 17 years old was I was looking around me and I was seeing all sorts of wrong and bad things going on in my community in Redfern. I was seeing coppers kicking the shit out of black fellas for no reason. I was seeing us, not seeing, I was experiencing us being harassed, brutalised, picked on by not just ordinary, you know, garden variety Victoria police type police. I'm talking about the really seriously corrupt thugs under the notoriously corrupt Premier of New South Wales, Robert Askin. Robert Askin, he changed his name after he got his knighthood. His real name was Robin Askin, but he changed his name to Robert because he didn't think it was macho enough. You know, Robin, he thought it was too effeminate. Anyway, we won't go into that. Robert Askin and his notorious band of criminal thugs called the 21 Division of the New South Wales Police, attempted to do all sorts of things to us in Redfern. I saw stuff around me happening that put a fire in my belly. And yet, I look around me today, in 2011, in Melbourne of all places, you know. Melbourne, I moved to Melbourne 40 years ago. The first time I come to Melbourne, fresh from Redfern, I went to the Empress Hotel. The Empress Hotel. The equivalent of the Empress Hotel, the Builder's Arms in Melbourne, in Gertrude Street, which in them days was an Aboriginal pub. Now, there's a little thing in itself. In your lifetime, most of you young people, in your lifetime, within 1 mile of where we're sitting right now, there has been a modern day dispersal of Aboriginal people. In the same way, when I lived in Redfern in the early 70s, there were 35,000 Aboriginal people in Redfern. It was the biggest Aboriginal community in Australia. At that time in Fitzroy and Collingwood, there were around 8,000 to 10,000 Aboriginal people. Now, look at Redfern today. There's about 500 blackfellas left in Redfern. In Fitzroy, there's less than half a dozen families left. And the only sign you've got of Aboriginal people in Fitzroy nowadays is the gymnasium there and the occasional street people down Smith Street who everybody's trying to get rid of. What happened to the Fitzroy Aboriginal community? It's happened in your lifetime. It's happened under your nose. Some of you people who bought houses or live in Fitzroy are probably part of that problem that forced them Aboriginal people out, you know. And the Aboriginal people who were in Fitzroy when I first came here 40 years ago were in fact mostly Aboriginal people who were refugees from the various communities around this state, like Lake Tyres, like Cumraganja. Cumraganja up on the border of the Murray River that produced some of the greatest Aboriginal leaders of the 20th century. you know, who came here in 1936, set up an organisation called the Australian Aborigines League, who in 1939 staged the Day of Mourning in Sydney, along with the Aboriginal Progressive Association in New South Wales. You know, the Aboriginal Progressive Association in New South Wales, which had set up in 1937, was actually the follow-on organisation from the 1927, the first modern-day Aboriginal political organisation that had been inspired by the writings and workings of Marcus Garvey, the father of international black nationalism, the man who set up an international black consciousness organisation in the 1920s called UNEA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, an organisation that had a branch operating on the Sydney waterfront in the early 1920s. And two members of that organisation were two Aboriginal wharf labourers by the name of Tom Lacey and Fred Maynard. Those two men went on adapting and adopting the ideas of Marcus Garvey about economic independence, raising the self-esteem of Aboriginal people and land rights, adopting those ideas of Marcus Garvey into the Australian situation and created the first modern-day Aboriginal political organisation. All Aboriginal political organisations since have evolved from that sort of philosophical and ideological beginning. And yet you read your mainstream Australian history book. Who are the heroes in there, you know? People who can't speak English or, you know, speak mumbo-jumbo or promote assimilation, or who are the Jackies to the British colonialists? You know, where is the history of the long, unending, never-ending to this day resistance that has gone on? And today I look around, I mean, in the days in the 70s when I looked around and I saw all that injustice and bad things going on, at that moment in history, it was just 2 years or so since 90%, more than 90% of the Australian people had voted in the 1967 referendum in support of Aboriginal aspirations, in support of Aboriginal people in their desire for justice and land equity, you know. In excess of 90% of the Australian people. So back then, we were on a roll. We managed to assist in bringing down the McMahon government in 1972 with the legendary Aboriginal embassy, you know. These things are not taught in your schools when you get taught about Aboriginal history, you know. Why not? Why not? You know, why is it that young generation of students who come to me now at the age of 18 and 19 know nothing of any of this sort of stuff that's happened since, you know, in the lifetime of their parents? And how is it that I can still show John's film and people still don't know? Part of the reason is there's not enough Australian history books at this conference, folks. Next year when I come back, I want to say twice as many Australian history books here, including mine, I might add. Which by then will be written, folks, will be written. So, it's important to have a sense and understanding of some of this history, because today, in the last week or two, just pick up the Australian any time you're silly enough to do that. You're slaying it, man. When next time you go to the toilet, just pick up the Australian off the floor and have a look at some of the nonsense that's being written there at the moment, you know. There is a clear anti-Aboriginal agenda. Here are the cheerleaders of the likes of Jenny Macklin and the Mal Brough and the intervention crew, you know, and they've got their own little bunch of hand-picked lapdogs, black lapdogs, you know, the new right of black Australia, and surprising people amongst them, like the illustrious Professor of Indigenous Studies at this august institution, the University of Melbourne, folks, none other than Professor Marcia Langton herself, who, as I recall, when I knew Marcia more than 40 years ago, she was one of you lot. Yes, she was. I'm talking in a very general sense. I'm doing that unfortunate thing that some of us do sometimes and lumping yes all together. I know. I'm more conscious of that than anyone. But anyway, in a general sense, she was one of you. But then, you know, oh, that's no insult to you, Mob, because then for a long time she became one of us. But mercifully, she is no more. She's chosen a different path. But Marcia is a very formidable intellect. There's no doubt in that case. Although sometimes she's capable of coming up with some really wonderful political comedy, as she does in the latest monthly magazine. But that's another story. See, you people should have read that. You should have known what I was talking about. You're not keeping yourselves informed enough. And then we've also, in recent years, well, you know, let's go back a bit in history. John Pilger did his film in 1987. It was about, the film was essentially about what we, blackfellas, were likely to do in 1988 on the occasion of the great masturbation of the nation. Oh, sorry, the great celebration of the nation, the bicentennial. Anyhow, the bicentennial was of issue because the Hawke government had just sold us down the drain. After more than a decade of extremely effective Aboriginal political organising in what became generally known as the land rights movement, we achieved our peak by the time that Hawke became Prime Minister. And as a result of all of that political pressure that had gone on, and because of what we did at the 1982 Commonwealth Games, the Stolen Wealth Games in Brisbane, where we got under Joe Bjelke-Petersen's nose and hundreds of people got arrested, international publicity bad for Australia, we said to Hawke, after he did a double backflip, he came to power saying, my government will deliver national uniform land rights legislation to Aboriginal people. National, uniform, along the lines of the Northern Territory Act. In other words, freehold title, ownership of land. All states, if the state governments want to resist, my government will legislate and federal legislation will prevail under the provision of the 67 referendum, constitutional change, blah, blah, blah. I promise national uniform land rights. Well, it only took a fairly big campaign by the mining industry and some shifty work by the most corrupt politician in modern Australian history. I'm not saying that loosely, I'm talking seriously. Mr. Brian Burke, who at the time was the federal president of the ALP and at the time was the Premier of Western Australia, and as Premier of Western Australia was the biggest fundraiser of the ALP, gave him a lot of sway in the ALP. And so when he picked up his phone from Perth and said to Bob Hawke, hey, get your ass over here, Bobby. Bobby jumped on a plane and he flew over to Perth. One meeting between Brian Burke, Bob Hawke. Brian Burke says to Hawke, hey, don't start talking this land rights shit, mate. You're upsetting my mine and mates. You know, the big funders of our party, remember? You know, all the property development mates of ours who are funding our party. You know, forget the Avos. Think of us. Bob Hawke came back, end of land rights. That was the end of land rights. That's how land rights was destroyed in the national political agenda. You know, ever since then, the ALP have pretended, you know, that, oh, you know, land rights is old hat and, you know, that's all from the old rights agenda and all this shit. But let's not also forget that within the same period of government, when Paul Keating became Prime Minister, then we had what all you people have been told is the greatest thing that ever happened for Aboriginal people, the Mabo decision in the High Court. Well, folks, you know, there were two of us at least who said at the time, this is a three-card trick. Me and Michael Mansell said, native title, what's native title? And so the Native Title Act was created by the Keating government. Why? To give land justice to Aboriginal people, which is what was said when the Native Title Act was proclaimed and in Parliament you had all of those people going clicking glasses of champagne together, Lowitch O'Donoghue, Paul Keating, Noel Pearson, Marcia Langton, all the architects of the Native Title Act. All the architects of the Native Title Act. And so me and Mansell said, what's Native Title? And the Native Title Act itself was designed to confirm white ownership of land. It had nothing to do with giving anything to us because it didn't give anything to us. If I had native title over the University of Melbourne, does that make me rich? Does that make me any the better off? Does that make me feel good? Not particularly, because why? If I'm the native title owner of Melbourne University, Round Parkville, does that mean I can go down there and build myself a little humpy in the courtyard down there? No way, folks. Does it mean that I can even necessarily walk on here at any time I like after dark or any time of the day or night? Not necessarily at all, no. Does it mean then, well, can I maybe charge the university rent for all these buildings that are stuck on my native title ground? Absolutely not. Does it mean that all this multi-million dollar buildings that are constantly going on at Melbourne University, say future building projects, maybe I can get a little bit of a cut out of that? No way. So what's my native title worth? sweet bugger all. I mean, what's native title? What's that mean? That means that when I come in here, somebody can say, we'd like to pay our due respects to the traditional owners of the land, you know. And I'm supposed to feel warm inside and say, wow, you know, great, that's good. Big deal, folks. Native title is not land rights. Rule number one. Reconciliation is not justice. Where did reconciliation come from? Not long after the Bicentennial, well, in the lead up to the Bicentennial, the Hawke government was under a lot of pressure. Aboriginal activists said we were going to stuff up the birthday party. We were going to create bad international headlines. We're going to, you know, do all these bad things. Bob Hawke got nervous. He tried to appease us, come up, pull a few rabbits out of the hat to try and divide the Aboriginal community, you know, get the Conservatives on side. He said, what we need is a Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. Now, nobody had ever mentioned anything about reconciliation up until this moment. When Bob Hawke, desperately looking for some distraction, something to distract some of the activists from the task of organising against the Bicentennial, pull a rabbit out of that, a car. Council Aboriginal, we'll make Pat Dodson the chair of this new Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. That's where reconciliation entered the Australian political language. It wasn't as a result of some spontaneous desire on the part of your community or any great, you know, claims from our community demanding, we weren't marching down the street saying, we want reconciliation. We were saying, we want land rights, you know. And so reconciliation, one of the things he pulled out. Then the other thing he pulled out, set up a Royal Commission on Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, $50 million. $50 million worth, which spent all the money. The lawyers had a picnic, you know, a few lawyers bought a few swimming pools and things, new flash car. Here we are 20 years later. The whole major thrust of the Royal Commission recommendations were that there were lots of blacks dying in jails in Australia because there were so many blacks in Australian jails. Disproportionate representation. The thrust of the 300 recommendations of the Royal Commission, and I worked on it, the thrust of the recommendations were designed to try and stop Aboriginal people going to jail in the numbers they were. Today, we've got twice as many blackfellas in jail as there were at the end of the Royal Commission. Yippee, you know. One of those people in jail is my oldest son. He's in he rang me up the other day. I said, are you all right, son? He said, yeah, yeah, Dad, sweet. I said, you all right, neither, looking after you? He said, son. He said, Dad, we're sweet. I said, a lot of blackfellas in there? He said, Dad, the jail's full of blackfellas. We run the joint. And my son's been in a couple of New South Wales jails, unfortunately. And as he said to me before, you know, every jail he goes to, there are more blackfellas there than you've ever seen, you know. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable, folks. And I really can't understand why, you know, not for me to say, I really can't understand what a new generation of a lot more educated and smarter young blackfellas, instead of going out and feathering their nests and furthering their careers in places like this, why aren't they out in the streets or doing something to counter this sort of stuff that's going on now? Because it was a fraction of this sort of injustice that we saw 40 years ago that got us off our asses and got to kick some ass. But then by the same token, to be fair on the new generation, instead of having a situation where we had significant support in the broader Australian community as we did in them days, today it's a different kettle of fish altogether. John Howard stole Pauline Hanson's ideas and incorporated them into the mainstream, and it's now become acceptable to openly express racist attitudes and thoughts, you know, to such an extent that we've got a Labor Party that's just picked up where Mel Brough left off, you know, and we've got a minister for I was thinking the other day, you know, I keep on saying in talks like this, Jenny Macklin's the worst Minister for Aboriginal Affairs we've ever had. But, folks, if I think about it, I've known every Minister for Aboriginal Affairs there's ever been. I've had dealings with them all except Mel Brough. And if I think about it, I can remember saying about every single one of them, this minister's the worst minister we've ever had. But, folks, it's true. And you look at, and I'm in the process of writing a little piece about all the ministers they've ever been. We started off with, some of you are probably a bit young to remember, Silly Billy Wentworth. One of the great hilarious, well, nutcases of Australian politics, you know. Even though his old man was one of the three white fellas who some black fellas showed across the Blue Mountains way back, you know. By the time it got round to Billy's generation of the Wentworth family, he well and truly got, you know, lost his marbles.
And he was renowned as a lunatic anti-communist fanatic. And the only thing that he, as Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, he was the first Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, the only thing he was ever interested in doing was finding out which one of these Abos are a commie, which one of these blacks are red, you know. And so he was a wonderful minister. And from that point on, virtually all ministers have shown one thing. It's a remarkable phenomenon in Australian politics. You get a politician from nowhere, Jenny Macklin, who's of fairly mediocre intelligence and who's probably never had an original thought in her life, but she's the same as all the rest. The minute they become Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, suddenly, overnight, they go through this magical transformation. A transformation into somebody who was a complete fuckwit and knew fuck all yesterday, into the world expert on all things Aboriginal, you know, and who can then make proclamations, you know. And one of the significant things about when I was looking at John Bilger's film yesterday, the new film, one of the significant thoughts I had is there's a classic example in Australian society now with journalism as a profession and Australian journalists turning a blind eye and studiously ignoring what's going on with the intervention. You won't find the intervention analysed in any depth whatsoever, really, in mainstream Australian media. Most of the Australian media are cheerleaders for the intervention. You've got the ABC, who are as complicit in some of the propaganda, this pro-intervention propaganda that's been produced, as complicit as anything that Rupert Murdoch and his crew are putting out. And it's a weird thing in Australia. John's got a lot more faith in journalism as a profession than I have, in that I look around me amongst all the journalists that I know, and I've known a lot over the last 40 years in Australia. It seems to me today that at least half of working journalists in the mainstream Australian media work for Rupert Murdoch, and the other half play their cards both ways. They're careful not to tread on the toes of Rupert Murdoch because one day they will work for him or want to work for him. And that worries me, you know. It worries me when you look at what's going on with the News of the World fiasco in London at the moment, which is wonderful. It keeps creeping closer to Rupert's office, you know. And I've been watching it for 5 years, reading The Guardian for 5 years, just waiting for it to get closer. And I hope it gets there, but, you know. The possibility of Australians really speaking out or contesting, you know, what's challenging what's happening with Jenny Macklin's policy. You see, Jenny Macklin, she goes on television occasionally when she finds a timid television reporter, and she just prattles on, you know, the same old mantra, the same old shit, and she never gets questioned. She never gets challenged. In the same way as what was being shown last night in John's film, you know, her version of things just gets presented and there's no real opposing view, you know. And so I actually think that things are far worse today than they've ever been. And a few years ago, my mad mate Richard Bell, one of the great Aboriginal artists, my favourite Aboriginal artist, I can remember when he was a bullshit artist. And I said to him, mate, all you've done is now put it on paint, make all you an artist. He said, yeah, don't tell him. Richard did a series of paintings a few years ago, which really worried me. I mean, you know, Richard's done some pretty outrageous stuff. You should enrich yourselves and go and look at some of his work. But to my way of thinking, one of the most outrageous series of paintings he did was a set called There Is No Hope, and it consisted simply of a series of canvases with a certain colour background and the writing, There Is No Hope. Each one was written in different colours. And this got under my skin, and it really troubled me, and it troubled me for a while, and eventually I went and seen Richard, and I said, listen, well, you can't say that. He said, what can't I say, Father? I said, mate, you can't say that there's no hope. You know, I said, there's got to be hope. You know, what else have we got? Only hope. He said, Foley, you of all people, ought to know that I'm right. How dare you come here and bullshit me? And so we had this long argument over a period of months, you know, arguing backwards and forwards. And eventually, after lots of thinking and agonising, I decided he's right. And so I rung him up. And I said, Rishi, brother, I said, you know what? I think you're right. He said, what? I said, I think you're right, mate. There is no hope. He said, Foley. He said, Foley, what's the matter with you? He said, there's got to be hope. Don't talk shit to me. You of all people should know. And he's right. But the only hope, I reckon, is that you mob need to educate yourselves more about what's going on now. And there are good people out there writing in a variety of all sorts of different places. You'll come across some good analyses of what's going down and why. But it's important for you to inform yourself so that you know, so that next time you get one of these little sharp-suited Melbourne University law students coming here and saying, oh, gee, I think that Noel Pearson's a really wonderful Aboriginal guy, don't you? Then you'll be able to say, no, he ain't. He's a product of Joe Majerky Peterson Lutheranism, you know? Yeah, wake up to yourself. Understand what this Cape York cane toad is all about. So, folks, I urge you, educate yourselves, then educate the people. Thank you.